Hi, this is Ethan Siegel, theoretical astrophysicist. I got my PhD from University of Florida in 2006 in physics. My thesis was titled Cosmological Perturbations and Their Effects on the Universe from Inflation to Acceleration. And my specialties are working on early universe physics, on dark matter and dark energy, on the origin and fate of the universe. And more recently, I've focused my efforts on writing and communicating about science to the general public through books, through speeches, lectures, and most famously, my blog, Starts With a Bang.
I've read quite a few of your articles for Starts With a Bang, and I met you at a science communications summit that we're going to talk about at the end of this episode. But before we get to that, I've mainly been talking to astronomers that deal with comets, since it's all been about Tuai Borisov. And so I'm really excited to have a theoretical astrophysicist on here where we can talk about cosmology and all these different things. And before we get to cosmological perturbations, I want to talk about Olber's paradox, because when I first heard that in my first astronomy class, I walked out of the class and I couldn't really wrap my head around it at first. It took me a whole afternoon of rereading the whole section and talking with my classmates. So could you kind of go over that paradox? And the cosmic microwave background gives hint to the alternative to Olber's paradox.
Right. So Olber's paradox is actually, it goes way back even before, like, you know, astrophysics was a thing, before we knew that galaxies beyond the Milky Way were a thing. This goes back to the days of, like, just plain old mathematics. If you take an imaginary universe and you fill it full of stars, doesn't matter how dense the stars are. It could be a very low density universe where you only have stars really rarely separated by many, many light years. But you can imagine that, okay, if the universe were infinite and it had a finite density of stars in it, what would the night sky look like? And to anyone who's taken vector calculus, this is a great vector calculus problem. You could just say, okay, if I imagine I have a uniform density of stuff and I'm going to do a three-dimensional integral and I'm going to recognize that the brightness of a light source falls off as 1 over the distance squared, which it really does. You move something twice as far away and it appears a quarter as bright. You move something 10 times farther away and it only appears 1% as bright. This is how flux works. This is how brightness works. But you do that integral and you say, okay, I'm going to say, okay, this is how the density of things is, right? It's just a constant. This is how the brightness of things falls off as 1 over the distance squared. But as I go farther and farther out, I can see that I'm actually getting, when I double the radius, I'm getting 8 times the amount of volume and 4 times the amount of surface area that I'm looking at, because of how the volume of a sphere and the surface area of a sphere work. Volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r cubed. Area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. So you say, okay, I'm going farther and farther out and I'm viewing more and more stars, but they're appearing fainter and fainter. And you do that integral, right? That's what calculus is all about, integrals. So you do that integral and you say, oh no, my series diverges. That I get a logarithmically divergent function, which means as I go farther and farther and farther into the universe, I'm actually collecting more and more and more light. And you can argue based on this that if the universe is infinite, full of stars, and has a uniform density, that would disprove a dark night sky, because no matter how long it took you on your little line of sight, no matter how far you went, you would eventually run into the surface of a star. And the most common objection to that is, oh, but the universe has more than just stars in it. It has dust in it too. So could that dust just be blocking the light? After all, that is what we see when you look at the Milky Way galaxy. You see this big band of dust in it. And the answer is, not if the universe was infinite. Because if the universe was infinite and full of stars, then any dust grain would also see starlight in all directions, and that dust would heat up until it too was emitting light. And so you can say, okay, clearly the sky is dark at night, and clearly, you know, we know the universe can't be infinite, infinitely old, and full of matter, full of stars everywhere, or it wouldn't appear dark. So why does the night sky appear dark? And there were a lot of people who made a lot of arguments about how the night sky could still appear dark. Maybe the universe wasn't infinite after all. Maybe the universe had a moment before which it didn't form any stars, and that the stars are relatively recent. Or maybe the universe was finite in time and actually had a beginning. What's fascinating about this is what you alluded to as the resolution of Olbert's paradox. If you say the universe began with a Big Bang, and it began with a Big Bang some 13.8 billion years ago, that means a whole slew of fascinating things. First off, it doesn't tell us whether the universe is finite or infinite. It could be either. But what it does tell us is that the part of the universe that's observable to us today is finite. That if I look more than about 46 billion light years away in any direction, I'm not going to hit any stars, any galaxies, because they haven't formed. I'm limited by the amount of time that light could have traveled since that Big Bang. So I only see a finite part of my universe, what we call the observable universe. You can say, all right, well, I see that because I only have this finite amount of space I can access with a finite amount of matter in it, then I don't get these divergences. I don't get this, you know, oh, the logarithm as it goes to infinity is going to give me infinity, and that's a big problem, because you're not going to infinity. You're going to some finite value. We can say, you know, there are a huge number of galaxies in the visible universe, about 2 trillion of them, but that's a finite number. That's not infinitely bright. So you distribute 2 trillion galaxies all throughout the universe, and that's why the sky looks dark at night. But what's also fascinating about that is if you had microwave eyes, eyes that instead of seeing light at around 3000 Kelvin, which our eyes are really well adapted to see, that we could see light of around 3 Kelvin, which our eyes are not adapted to see at all, you would actually see that the sky was bright everywhere. And that is because there is a leftover glow from the hot, dense state of the Big Bang. Back in the early days, they gave it a wonderful name. They used to call it the primeval fireball. What a good name.
Yeah.
Today, we call it the cosmic microwave background, which is more informative because it's in the microwave portion of the radio spectrum, of the light spectrum. But, you know, but primeval fireball really has a nice ring to it, because that is the leftover glow from the Big Bang of what was called all the way back in the 1920s, the primeval atom, which is what they called the Big Bang back in the day too. But as a physicist, you know, I care a lot more about that we know what these things are rather than, we didn't give a good name to them. I'm not in charge of naming, but I'm happy to let you know, like, you want to say primeval fireball, you're not only going old school, you're going poetic too.
Yeah, it'd be more clickbaity, I guess, in astronomy articles. But if you could rewind time back far enough, could you shift it from microwave back into the optical? Because I once asked one of my professors, and he said that the initial fireball would have looked orange in the visible spectrum.
I mean, if you go back in time, the best thing that we can say about the cosmic microwave background, this was experimentally and observationally demonstrated in the 1990s. Some people had worked on it in the 80s, but the real good evidence came in the 90s with the COBE satellite. This is a black body spectrum of radiation. And so what you need to know that means is, if you took a perfectly black object, something that only absorbed radiation, that it didn't reflect anything, and you heated that up, it would emit light with a certain spectral shape. It would emit a certain amount of blue light and certain amount of green light, yellow light, red light, and also ultraviolet and more energetic, and infrared and less energetic. It emits a certain spectrum known as a black body. When the universe expands, right, you run the clock forward and you watch the universe expand. One of the key aspects of this radiation is it keeps that same spectral shape, but as the universe expands, it drops in temperature, right? That stretching of space stretches the wavelength of your light, but it stretches all the wavelengths of all your light, and that's why it appears lower energy. If you went back in time, what you would see if you went back continuously in time is this cosmic microwave background would become peaked in the far infrared, and then the mid infrared, and then the near infrared. And when it was peaked in the, I'll say in the red to near infrared, that's when you would get that, you know, oh, this is when the cosmic microwave background was emitted. This is the surface of last scattering. This is a moment in time, by the way, because when you have atoms, all the atoms that make us up, all the atoms that make up everything in our universe, there's only a finite temperature you can heat those atoms up to before they become an ionized plasma. And when you become an ionized plasma, you scatter, your electrons in particular, scatter very efficiently with photons. It's only when you become neutral, when those highest energy photons at the edge of your black body spectrum aren't numerous enough to keep ionizing your atoms, that you form neutral atoms and that this cosmic microwave background can stream to your eyes. So if you were at that time, you would be like, yeah, it does look kind of orange-red. But all of that radiation still exists at earlier and earlier times, too. It's just also scattering off of electrons, protons, and everything else in your universe. So if you went back in time to when the universe was 380,000 years old, you would say, oh yeah, it's kind of orange-red. But if you went back to a time where the universe was about 100,000 years old, you would say, no, it's actually more like a bluish, a whitish, bluish color. And if you went back even further, you would say, oh, like this is much hotter in the universe. Most of my light is ultraviolet now. And if you go back farther and farther and farther, you can start to say, oh no, now we're getting to points where it's too hot to form atomic nuclei and I'm blasting them apart. And it's too hot to even just have my photons collide with other photons and suddenly I'm producing matter-antimatter pairs. And suddenly it's too dense that I can't even produce protons and neutrons because it's indistinguishable from a quark gluon plasma. So as we extrapolate back astrophysically to these earlier times, we're also seeing higher densities and higher temperatures and higher energies and reactions that don't occur in the modern day universe, except in the highest energy particle collisions that we create.
So the cosmic microwave background is at least 380,000-ish years after this initial era, and light was finally free to stream outward. When we look at this background with either WMAP or COBE, or Planck satellite.
Yeah, if you're not biased against the European Space Agency, Planck satellite has done it the best out of all of them. That COBE was first gen, WMAP was second gen, and Planck is what I'll call last gen because it's getting all the information in 9 different frequency bands down to, you know, the maximum cosmic resolution that the universe permits us to observe this at.
The maximum for these microwave wavelengths?
Yeah. If you were to go, I don't think this is greatly appreciated because a lot of people are like, oh, well, why can't you just build one with more wavelength bands and higher spatial resolution and better temperature resolution? And the answer is we could, but we wouldn't learn anything useful about the cosmic microwave background. Because one of the things that goes on in the universe is, yes, this light was emitted from a surface, from an atom, whatever, from when the universe was less than 400,000 years old. But in order to arrive at our eyes, that light has to pass through about 40 some odd billion light years worth of space. It has to travel for 13.8 billion years through the expanding matter and radiation filled universe before it arrives at our eyes. If we go to make better measurements with better equipment at higher precision, higher resolution, more wavelength bands, etc., we will observe things to better precision, no doubt, but it's not going to teach us more about the early universe. It's only going to measure the effects of what happens to that light as it travels through the universe to our eyes. Those are the dominant effects. So what we got from Planck, this is arguably the best information we're really capable of getting about the universe with this data set. The one exception is when you have the Planck data set of temperature fluctuations, there is an additional complementary set that still hasn't been fully analyzed from the polarization of that light. So that's coming in too, and that's going to be informative to us. But I don't want people to be left with the impression that, like, oh, well, things change from COBE to WMAP and things change from WMAP to Planck, and they'll change again as we go from Planck to the next gen satellite. No, Planck is it. Planck is it for what we're going to learn about the cosmic microwave background from this type of experiment.
Well, relating this back to what you wrote about, if you were looking at those big 360 maps of the CMB, you would see different greens and reds and blues. What is the degree of which the temperature actually changes in this edge, this boundary? And could you relate it also to the perturbations that you wrote about?
Sure. So one of the things you have to appreciate about the Big Bang in general is that it makes four predictions that alternatives don't make all of these four. We talked about extrapolating back to this hot, dense state. We talked about going farther and farther back in time to higher temperatures and getting these specialized reactions that only occur when you have these high density, high temperature, high energy regions. One of them is that during the early stages where you are forming these protons and neutrons and trying to bind them together at these high nuclear temperatures, but you also have the photons working to blast them apart, we come up with predictions for what we call Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which is what are the abundances, the initial abundances before you ever form stars of the light elements, hydrogen, deuterium, helium-3, helium-4, lithium, etc., right? You can calculate those abundances and go out and look for them, and they match, and that's amazing. But that's one. You also get the prediction for an expanding universe that expands in a specific way over time, depending on what the various components of energy, like normal matter, dark energy, etc., are present in your universe, right? So that's a second prediction, is the expanding universe. The third prediction is the cosmic microwave background. But the fourth is that you should get a universe that was born almost perfectly uniform, but with slight overdensities and underdensities, where the overdensities will eventually grow into the stars, galaxies, galaxy clusters, and filaments of the large-scale structure of the universe that we see today. Whereas the underdense regions are going to be more likely to give up their matter to all the surrounding regions. So when you ask the question of what's the role of those little temperature fluctuations I see, on average, these temperature fluctuations are about one part in 30,000. So when you're talking about, you know, 2.725 Kelvin is the mean temperature of the cosmic microwave background, you're talking about, oh, the hotter temperature regions are tens or maybe 100 or 200 microkelvin hotter than average. And the colder regions are up to maybe 200 microkelvin colder than the average region. That's it. It's a very small difference But that difference is so important because of where it arises from. The temperatures are not hotter or colder because the radiation is hotter or colder. The temperatures are hotter and colder because of this general relativistic phenomenon called gravitational redshift. If the universe has an average density to it, you can imagine an overdense region as being a place where space is curved more severely, where you're basically in a hole relative to the average universe because you have more gravity there. In order to send your light out of the hole, right, light can only move at the speed of light, so it's not going to slow down. What it's going to do, though, is lose energy. It's going to be slightly shifted towards the redder part of the spectrum, which means it's going to appear slightly colder. So when you see a cold spot in the cosmic microwave background, that corresponds to a region of slightly greater than average density. And when you see a hot spot, it corresponds to like a positive bump where you have slightly more than average density. So when you look and you see that map of temperature fluctuations, that is a map of what the universe 13.8 billion years ago looked like in terms of matter density. So we can use this temperature map to reconstruct what the matter overdensities and underdensities are. And these are the types of overdense and underdense regions that grow over time, that evolve over time, and lead to this great cosmic web we see with filaments dotted with galaxies, with nexuses between these filaments where clusters are, and with the giant voids in between. That's why the universe looks the way it does. The fact that we see all four of these things, the expanding universe, the abundance of the light elements from nucleosynthesis, the cosmic microwave background with its perturbations, and all the evidence we see for the formation and growth of large-scale structure in the universe, this is why none of the Big Bang's alternatives work and why the Big Bang is so successful as a scientific theory.
Okay, so it checks all four of those boxes. Just like
it does for anyone who's a real scientist who's interested in looking at the evidence, and it really has since the 1960s. There were a few holdouts, right? These are people who I will say universally did not believe in the Big Bang before the cosmic microwave background were discovered, and continued to not believe in the Big Bang until they died, often ignoring huge swaths of evidence in order to do so. And, you know, there aren't any, I'll say, viable alternatives, but that does not mean you won't find contrarian scientists who wrongly insist that there are. I'm just not going to name names, and just be aware that they're out there and what they're talking about is not to be taken seriously.
Well, back when this was all just theoretical, Einstein, with one of his equations, added the cosmological constant, and then he called it one of his biggest blunders. But it actually is, I mean, showing itself today now that we can see the acceleration of the universe.
So you're saying, hey, Einstein proposed a cosmological constant. He later called the cosmological constant his greatest blunder. And now, when we look at the universe since the late 90s, we discover we have to add dark energy into the mix. And guess what is the greatest candidate for dark energy of all? It's Einstein's cosmological constant. All of that is true, but it's also true that Einstein really did blunder when he proposed the cosmological constant. From a purely theoretical point of view, which is to say, if you're only going to look at the mathematics of general relativity and you aren't going to look at the universe, so you don't look at the universe, you just look at the math of what you've written down, the cosmological constant is a fine idea. Because when you are saying, I'm going to write down general relativity and here are Einstein's field equations, and what do they mean? What it tells you is, okay, we have on one side of the equation, we have all of the matter and energy present in the universe. You have this inherent, right? I add these things into my universe. and the matter and energy is going to tell my space how to curve. And then on the other side of the equation, I get that curved space, and I'm going to calculate how space is curved, and in particular, how that affects the motion of matter and energy in my universe. So on the one hand, you have how space and time evolve, and on the other hand, you have all the matter and energy present in the universe. The thing is, you can add in one extra thing. And the reason you can only add in one extra thing is because all those other things that you can imagine, oh, maybe there's a vector field in the universe, maybe there's a scalar field permeating the universe, right? All of these things change general relativity. General relativity wouldn't be general relativity anymore if you added those things in. But you can add in a cosmological constant, which is basically a uniform, non-zero amount of energy inherent to the fabric of space itself. And Einstein's equations still work just fine if you add that in. You can say there's a non-zero amount of energy inherent to space itself, and that still allows Einstein's equations to all be valid. That's the idea of a cosmological constant. And for that, Einstein didn't do anything wrong. Now, let's get to the point where he did do something wrong. The reason Einstein put his cosmological constant in there is because he said, hey, I'm going to look at the universe the same way Olbers did. I'm going to look at the universe and assume that it is uniformly filled with matter. And I'm going to say that's my universe. My universe is big. It's uniformly filled with matter. And if I put that into my equations, what do I get out? And the answer is an unstable universe. If you say, okay, I want all these masses to be at the same distance from one another, and I want them to stay that way, what do? You go ahead, you write that down, you put in your equations, you solve them, and you discover that your universe is going to collapse. And it's going to collapse down into a black hole, and it's going to do it fast. And Einstein was like, no, 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 that's bad. I'm going to put in this cosmological constant to push back against it so that when matter tries to collapse, I'm going to have this cosmological constant work against it. Other people went and solved this equation and said, hey, Einstein, you know, when you have like x squared equals 4, you know that x doesn't have to be 2. Right? It could also be negative 2, because negative 2 squared is the same as positive 2 squared is equal to 4. So when they solved the equations, they said, actually, it's very generic. Your universe doesn't have to collapse down to a black hole. Your universe could be contracting, or it could also be expanding. And if you don't put this cosmological constant in there, you discover that in a universe that's uniformly filled with stuff, it must be either expanding or collapsing. And Friedman wrote this to Einstein, and Lemaître solved it independently, and he wrote it to Einstein, and Einstein called his physics abominable, even though his mathematics was correct. And Howard Robertson did it in 1928, and Einstein didn't care. And finally, when Hubble published his Hubble constant paper, where he started to measure the expansion of the universe, it was only in the aftermath of that that Einstein was like, oh, I might have messed up. There was not this like, oh, everyone else was right. There was like, oh, I might have messed up. And years later, when speaking to George Gamow, Gamow is the one, and Gamow is known as the father of the Big Bang for basically proposing the theory in close to its modern form in the 1940s, Gamow recounts that Einstein called it his greatest blunder. And historians of science think that's very consistent with Einstein's opinions later in life. But yeah, we appear to have something that looks like a cosmological constant today. But also, let's get real. Einstein was still wrong. Yes, a cosmological constant can exist in general relativity. Yes, it has profound effects. No, it's not the effects that Einstein thought it had. It's not there for the reasons Einstein thought it was there. In fact, Einstein's whole reason for putting it forward and his insistence on it really kept cosmology from just following the equations and discovering the expanding universe. There was a lot more resistance to it because of Einstein and honestly what I will just call his dogma about the static universe.
Yeah. And I mean, he was wrong about other things too, or at least he was really hesitant to accept quantum mechanics as well.
If you can't call Einstein wrong about something, then we don't have hope for like for our society. I don't want to take people's scientific heroes away from them, but the instant your scientific hero becomes always right and infallible and incapable of being wrong, then you've got a cult of personality rather than science. And I want to do everything I can to steer people away from this. And I don't want to steer them towards following me or listening to me because I don't want to be that false hero or that cult of personality either. But let's make sure we know that every individual idea gets evaluated based on its scientific merits and nothing else beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Scientists are all still human.
Very much so, with all the human failings and foibles that we all have. So right now, when we take a look at the full suite of data sets from Planck, from supernova data, from all other distance ladder measurements, from the clustering and clumping of matter and large-scale structure and baryon acoustic oscillations and all sorts of other data sets, when we combine them all together, we wind up with one coherent picture of what's in the universe, what makes up the universe. There's a tiny amount in a whole bunch of things, right? Black holes are about a few millionths of a percent of the mass and energy in the universe. And you can say, okay, there's plasmas, and there's gas, and there's dust, and there's atoms, and there's planets, and there's stars. And you can take all the different forms of normal matter combined, neutron stars, white dwarfs, brown dwarfs, red dwarfs, anything you want, all of that is about 4.9% of the total energy density of the universe. You can say, oh, but what about radiation, right? There's the cosmic microwave background. There's all the photons that stars produce. That's about 0.01%, about 1/10,000th of the universe is radiation. It was more important earlier in the universe, back when things were hotter and denser, but as the universe has expanded and cooled, radiation is now only about 0.01% of what's left. You might remember neutrinos and say like, oh yeah, like, aren't there these ghostly particles? They're actually more important than photons by now. They're about 0.1% of the total mass of the universe. They're the only form of dark matter, of non-baryonic dark matter, matter that isn't made of protons, neutrons, and electrons that we actually understand. But most of the universe is dark matter and dark energy, these things we don't understand. About 27% of the total universe is made up of dark matter, which acts like normal matter in terms of its gravitational interactions, but as far as we can tell, has no other interactions, does not have nuclear interactions, does not interact with light or matter, normal matter in any way. That's dark matter. And finally, the largest component of the universe, 68%, approximately 2/3 of the energy in the universe, is in the form of dark energy, which is indistinguishable, as far as we can tell, from a cosmological constant. So that's the inventory of the universe as best as we understand it. And the uncertainties on those numbers are really only on the order of maybe at most 3% or so.
Well, one fact that I've heard you say that's a consequence of that dark energy is that even if we left Earth at the speed of light, 97% of galaxies are already out of reach.
Yeah, I have said that. I have said that. And I would like to clarify that after doing a more rigorous calculation, it actually looks like it's only like 95-point-something% that are out of reach. But that's still pretty bad, right? And the reason is, if you left today at the speed of light and you took a distant galaxy and noted that the space between you and them is expanding, right, there would be a certain speed that that galaxy would appear to recede at you from. So you can say, okay, I'm going to take the Hubble constant, right, and let's assume it's 70 kilometers a second per megaparsec. That's a speed per unit distance. And you can say, okay, so 70 kilometers a second per megaparsec. Without even knowing what a megaparsec is, you can say, okay, well, if I went 10 megaparsecs away, then that thing would appear to speed away from us at 700 kilometers a second. And if I went 1,000 megaparsecs away or a gigaparsec away, I would discover that, okay, now it's moving away at 70,000 kilometers a second. The speed of light is only 300,000 kilometers a second. So you start moving between 4 and 5 gigaparsecs away, and you can't reach those galaxies, because even if you left at the speed of light or arbitrarily close to the speed of light, that galaxy would only get further and further away from you as time went on. In fact, this is one of the exciting things that I hope we get to measure over the next 10 or 15 years or so, is this effect called redshift drift, where we will actually get to measure the expansion of the universe directly over the time scale of about a decade, that you can measure how fast a galaxy is moving away from you today. And then 10 years later, you can actually measure that it'll be moving away from us faster because the universe has expanded. And now this galaxy is slightly more megaparsecs away than it was before in the expanding universe.
One thing that I've heard is that the discovery of gravitational waves, eventually it could let us probe past the cosmic microwave background that we were talking about earlier.
You know, that's true. So this is a prediction from what we know as inflation. If you didn't have inflation, you would predict that when you got all the way up to arbitrarily hot and dense energies, you would get a particular spectrum of gravitons. And if you want to go back through the literature, you can find a paper from, I think, 2005, maybe 2004, titled "A Thermal Graviton Background from Extra Dimensions." And you might even recognize the first author as me on that. But yeah, you can get a spectrum of gravitons or gravitational waves from the early universe. If inflation is correct, you should get a specific signature. If inflation's not correct, you should get a very different signature. So being able to detect one of those two signatures should be another test of inflation. The only difficulty we have is that with the inflationary prediction, it's model specific what the amplitude of that signal is. We know what the spectrum of those gravitational waves should be, but the amplitude is unknown, and there is a tremendous amount of wiggle room. So people are building detectors to try and look for that signature of gravitational waves from inflation, but only if we get a particularly kind variant of inflation are we going to be able to detect that background with our instruments. If inflation is a model that produces low amplitude gravitational waves, we won't be able to see it, but they should exist. And that's something that, you know, is on the frontiers of gravitational wave science right now.
Yeah, and gravitational waves can also be detected by themselves or with other messengers, tri-messenger or bi-messenger events. And so that is sometimes referred to as multi-messenger astronomy. And so now we can finally talk about the GEMMA Summit and MMA. So you wrote an awesome article a week and a half ago about MMA and why it's the future of astronomy. So could you give us a definition or a description of multi-messenger astronomy and some examples of it?
Yeah, so long before you had sumo wrestlers fighting, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu fighters, and before you had like Ken Shamrock and all those guys, MMA was a concept that was well known to astronomers. But it wasn't mixed martial arts, it was multi-messenger astronomy. And, you know, you can think about all the different ways we look at the universe, you know, the gamma rays, the X-rays, the ultraviolet, the visible light, the infrared, the microwave, and the radio, and you can take all those different ways and note that they're all looking at different forms of light. We call that multi-wavelength astronomy, and that actually got started back in the 1700s when William Herschel discovered infrared radiation, which was a huge discovery. Over the 20th century, we got really good at launching observatories into space, at examining the full suite of this wavelength range, and seeing all the different signals we could get. But we recognize fundamentally it's all still light. However, there are two other fundamental types of signatures that we could also detect. One of them is particles. Instead of photons, we can measure electrons or positrons or neutrinos or any number of particles that exist from that are created in these catastrophic reactions. So in 1987, we had a supernova go off, and we got at neutrino detectors across the world, we started to see a flux of neutrinos. Three different detectors saw signatures of neutrinos hitting their reactors. They all came from the same source in the sky, from the same direction, and they all arrived within about, I want to say, 10 to 13 seconds of one another. And they got a total of 21 neutrinos at these different observatories. And then a few hours later, light arrived from that same direction in the Large Magellanic Cloud, because a supernova had gone off just 168,000 light years away. The neutrinos were produced first, and because neutrinos do not interact with matter, they simply traveled through the star that generated them to our detectors. The light took a while to propagate out, and that's why it arrived a little bit later. So we look at that and you say, oh, that's a fundamentally different type of messenger. That's a particle. It's a neutrino. But in general, it's a particle. And it came along with the light. This allowed us to do all sorts of things we could never do without the particles. It allowed us to understand the nuclear reactions that took place during the conflagration stage. During the conflagration stage of a type 2 supernova. It allowed us to measure the speed of neutrinos and place constraints on their mass based on their energy. It allowed us to compare the speed of neutrinos to the speed of light and find they were indistinguishable. We could start doing neutrino astronomy because of this event. So today we have other particle detectors that are much more sophisticated, things like Ice Cube, that have detected cosmic particles from not just hundreds of thousands, but from billions of light years away. This is extremely exciting. But we also have, thanks to LIGO and Virgo and the new generation of gravitational wave detectors, we also have the ripples in space itself. We also have gravitational waves, which are fundamentally their own type of messenger. You have to have different specialized detectors to do this. A gravitational wave detector with its twin laser arms, it doesn't look like any type of telescope you're used to because it doesn't collect light from the universe. It just measures how distances change in particular orientations over time, which is the effect of a gravitational wave passing through you. So these three fundamentally different types of signals, or messengers as we call them, is where the idea of multi-messenger astronomy comes from. That yes, you can learn a lot from gravitational waves, or from cosmic particles, or from light. But you can learn unprecedented amounts about the universe when you observe these signals in concert, when you observe them together with one another. So when we saw the binary neutron star merger in 2017, and we got gravitational waves and electromagnetic signals from it, we learned about a number of things like the origin of gold in our universe and heavy elements and what a kilonova is and how it's tied to short period gamma ray bursts. We were able to do all of this because we got this multi-messenger signal. And as we look to the future of multi-messenger astronomy, We know a whole host of wonderful things are coming. We're going to, at some point, get the first trifecta signal where we detect gravitational waves and particles and electromagnetic radiation from the same event. We're going to see close up a black hole merger or a black hole neutron star merger, and we will get to see, is there an electromagnetic counterpart signal to them at all? When the next supernova goes off, yes, we will detect neutrinos and light from it. Will we also detect gravitational waves from it? That's a very interesting thing to look at as well. So there are lots of fascinating things that are coming in the pipeline where these are questions that we have ideas about but not answers to, and we're going to get the answers to them over the coming years and decades.
Well, hopefully listeners of the GEMMA podcast know that GEMMA stands for Gemini in the Era of Multi-Messenger Astronomy. And so multi-messenger astronomy is part of Gemini or GEMMA, but also TDA is as well. Is there anything TDA-wise that you're excited about in the future as well, like future surveys or detections?
You know, I'll say, so TDA in general, this is a much less well-known acronym, and it's one that I would hope that we just stop using to the general public at all, because it means too many different things at once. But when you say time domain astronomy, this is any signal that either varies or is collected over time. So when you do event horizon telescope stuff and you do phase locking of your various different telescopes, that's time domain astronomy. But also when you watch a burst or a variable star or a transient event, that's time domain astronomy. From a cosmological point of view, the most exciting time domain astronomy thing that I can imagine is, this is for the far future, but it's something that I see coming maybe within a century, is those hot and cold spots we talked about in the cosmic microwave background, those overdense and underdense regions. That comes from a specific region of space that's, you know, that it took the light 13.8 billion years to get here. Over time, that fluctuation pattern will start to change in shape, in size, as the light stops arriving from what's currently the appropriate distance region, and we'll start to see the light from behind it. In other words, we're going to start to be able, once enough time goes by, to understand how these cosmic perturbations, these overdense and underdense regions from when the universe was just 380,000 years old, we're going to witness them slightly change over time. So we will get to see what a three-dimensional look at these cosmic perturbations looks like. That's the most exciting thing that I can imagine coming in the relatively near future from time domain astronomy, even though that's a technology that's probably, you know, going to be pushing the boundaries of our lifetimes.
I can't wait to view that. Probably be in VR by the time that they have that kind of technology.
I'll be okay experiencing that in VR.
So we met at the GEMMA Summit, which took place November 7th and 8th, 2019. Were there any interesting topics or problems that were discussed? Because I know we also had polls and discussions over the name itself, multi-messenger astronomy.
I mean, there were a lot of interesting things. If you wanted me to give you my three biggest takeaways from that meeting, the first is that nobody likes the name multi-messenger astronomy, and nobody, really nobody, likes the term time domain astronomy. But this is what astronomers are using, and we don't have an immediately superior term that makes everyone happy. And so we looked, we saw it, and we failed to find them. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it also means maybe like primeval fireball, even if we found the ultimate term, that people would still be like, yeah, I don't want it. And that's fine. But it's the old Shakespeare to me, a rose by any other name would smell just as sweet. So if this is what we're going to call it, we might as well call it that. But let's do our best to communicate the thing that matters. The fact is, it doesn't matter that this is multi-messenger astronomy. What matters is that we are getting these fundamentally different types of signals from the universe, combining them together and learning more than we can from any method independently. That is the big takeaway. The other thing that I think is a huge takeaway is how we communicate this matters. When we're an institution that makes a big discovery or a collaboration, it is so important to have a unified message where you are getting that message across clearly and concisely to the general public. That is the most important thing that needs to happen, not satisfying the egos of all the hundreds or thousands of different members in the collaboration. We were able to identify some teams that really nailed this, and we were able to identify some teams that I won't put on blast on your podcast that could really use some improvements. And I do have some very strong opinions on that, that I know many of our colleagues and many of the other people at the GEMMA meeting have as well. And I hope that this meeting was useful for them in pushing forward how we communicate science to the general public, because that is the reward that they get for investing in this. And I do not want to shortchange them at all. And lastly, the last big takeaway point I have from this is that we are pushing these frontiers of the unknown back, and we are discovering what exists in a place where we had only ignorance and conjecture before. This is the essence of science, is pushing those frontiers back, is learning what's behind that curtain, is revealing the next set of mysteries to solve that we wouldn't have even known what to ask before they were made. That this is not the end of science. This is not, oh, as astronomers, aren't you satisfied now? The answer is no. What we are learning now is, once we pull this frontier back, what is the next one? And how can we answer those questions? So questions like, yes, this is where the majority of gold comes from, but is neutron star mergers, are those the cause of all short period gamma ray bursts, or are there other causes? We still have to answer that. We are uncovering the tip of the iceberg right now, and that is amazing. But the next step is to measure the full extent of that iceberg, knowing full well that most of it is beneath the surface and invisible to us today.
Well, I'm looking forward to what MMA and TDA have to bring in the future. And thanks for helping reveal some of the mysteries of science for our podcast listeners today.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And hopefully your podcast listeners will come away from this more informed and more excited about multi-messenger astronomy, how it's useful for cosmology and the study of the universe, and where we're prepared to go with this new field of science in the 21st century.